Welcome to the 60th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that wants to ask Stuart Broad, what's wrong with batting on with a broken nose?
At the beginning of this series, I think if you had to pick which of the England players would have ended up with a broken nose, it would have to be Alistair Cook. Everything was going wrong in the series. But the one difference between the last podcast that we recorded and this one is that things have just turned around for Alistair Cook, haven't they?
Yeah, and I mean, we discussed in the last podcast, didn't we, the fact that there was this media image, really, of him as a dead man walking. Everyone had really given up on him, and there was that sense of inevitability. It wasn't a question, he was definitely going to go at some point. But then something happened at the Aegeus Bowl which really reminded me what a gulf there can be between the press box and the cricket-loving public. Cook came out to bat and was just given a staggering reception by the England fans. It was a standing ovation from any huge amount of noise. And when he was asked about it later, he said he'd never experienced anything like it at any point in his career. And you could see he was sort of visibly moved by what had happened.
Just as an aside, the title Aegeus Bowl is just a complete travesty for a cricket ground, isn't it?
Well, I'm a bit upset that I've started using it, isn't it? It kind of subtly slips into your vocab, doesn't it, without you wanting to be? Because actually, the Rose Bowl was a lovely name for a cricket ground.
And it was very evocative. It was very evocative, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, that was just an aside about the corporate nature of the game as it is nowadays.
Yeah. No, well, it was a sad point, well noted. But what I think was moving about it was that these England fans saw what I think a lot of us have maybe missed of late, which is that Cook is a deeply decent, talented young man who's gone through a hard patch, and they were just determined to get behind him. And I think it was a reminder, actually, that we're not supposed to be cricket consumers. We're not supposed to turn up, pay our money, and expect brilliance. We're supposed to be supporters, you know, get behind people, tie your own sort of emotions into the fortunes of others. And I think it was quite special, actually, to see that. Similarly, the response he got when he came in at lunch, unbeaten in the mid-40s, having admittedly had quite a scratchy session. Again, absolutely fantastic. These fans just did not want to see him fail.
There was a wonderful sense, you know, unlike that episode with Ian Botham, that famous episode with Ian Botham, where there was that sense that the crowd really did want him to fail. You know, that innings where he walked into the pavilion at Lord's and just no one applauded him after scoring a century. There is a real sense in which I think the public is sort of getting behind Cook and want him to succeed. Now, there's another batsman, actually, who he hasn't really been going through a rough patch, and he doesn't really go through rough patches, but I just wanted to take a moment to think about the glorious batsman that is Kumar Sangakkara, because he's one of those batsmen who just sort of slips under the radar a bit. And if people are asked to name their five greatest batsmen of all time, or whatever it is, or even five greatest batsmen playing the game nowadays, he's never one who really features on those kinds of lists. He does, though, have a test average of 58. He's just scored another double century, which is one against the Pakistanis, which is what kind of brought him to my, again, to the forefront of my mind. And he's actually, as well, just achieved a new world record. You might not have heard about this one. Now, this is the world record for the number of innings of 190 and over, which was previously held by Don Bradman, but is now held by Kumar Sangakkara after his most recent innings. And he's, as I say, he's just one of those batsmen who kind of slips under the radar. And so this is, my saying this is apropos of nothing other than
to note his contributions to the game, because you have this feeling, I certainly had it when Sri Lanka were over most recently, that with him and Jai Wardner, you've got two absolute greats who I think probably for no other reason other than that they play for Sri Lanka rather than one of the really, really big cricketing nations, have probably never quite got the recognition they deserve. And ultimately, realistically, we're seeing the last of them. Definitely good to appreciate these players at this time.
Now, away from the international game, you recently had an experience of which I am intensely jealous.
So I'm breaking with tradition in this episode. For the first time, it's been such a splendid, you know, splendid summer that I'm going with two highlights. I've had no cricketing low points this month. Now, if you designed my perfect day, it would look a lot like Words and Wickets, which is a new cricket literature festival that's been launched. I think its first year was last year. This was the second incarnation this year. It's set at Wormsley, which is just a glorious setting. I mean, it is perhaps the most idyllic cricket ground I've ever visited. If essentially you have the Authors 11 playing a game at Wormsley, and then round the boundary, all sorts of various cricket shenanigans. Highlights for me involved James Sherwood's comic cricket songs, which frankly doesn't sound like something I would enjoy, but actually was a lot of fun. Particular highlight involves the rhyming of Che Guevara with Chiteshwar Pujara. You know, that's art. There was a panel of journalists discussing their best and worst cricketing books. Now, the discussion of the best was very interesting, but it was the discussion of the worst that was really compelling. Dickie Bird and Monty Panesar coming in for a particular hammering. And there was a lovely point where Andrew Miller, the cricketer editor, talked about the fact that he finds that he always gets Dickie Bird books from relatives who know he likes cricket, but who themselves know nothing about cricket. And he says he has this pile of books from well-wishing relatives who think, oh, you know, Andrew likes his cricket. And I thought it summed it up rather perfectly. That is unfortunately when you'd get a Dickie Bird book. There was an actor who read an article from the Night Watchman, which sounds, frankly, a bit a slightly odd form of entertainment.
A bit dull, yeah.
It does, but was actually done brilliantly. And quite extraordinarily, it was Dilip Premachandran, who's the Wisden India editor. It was his article about Sachin Tendulkar. And I kid you not, there were tears in the crowd, which is quite an endorsement for someone's writing.
And how many, how many people were there at this? Was it the kind of thing, because it sounds like the kind of thing where it could be quite interactive between the people who were speaking and the people who were listening. It sounds quite small and intimate rather than a sort of a big conference.
Yes, so I was actually there on the Friday afternoon, and it was pretty intimate actually. It was quite a small crowd. There was definitely room for sort of dialogue. I think from what I heard, not surprising, the much, much bigger crowds came in on the Saturday. And you know, I hope for sort of the sake of the event that the numbers coming through the door were sort of sufficient to keep it going, because I think this is an event that deserves to have a good future. I also saw Boris Johnson's brother Joe batting for the Authors 11 and making a very impressive innings. Quite agricultural, lots of aggressive swipes, but yeah, that was a discovery to find that the Johnson family has plenty of sporting talent. We know Boris loves his table tennis and his tennis, actually. And his lesser known little brother turns out to have cricketing skill.
And what a lovely idea to combine, as you say, actually having a cricket game with talking about cricket at the same time. So it's not purely words and it's not purely wickets, I suppose, but as the title of the whole thing implies, it's a kind of combination of both.
Indeed, and you come across some, it's like one of those ideas you come across and you think, God, why hasn't anyone done this before? So yes, hope it goes from strength to strength. So you've been upset about something. Well, if that was cricketing high culture, you've been upset about what is really a desecration of cricketing culture.
Yeah, so I used to work, just sort of out of context, I used to work for an orchestra that travelled internationally quite a lot, and we used to have a lot of trouble when we went through customs with instruments. So you take a violin up to the customs desk and they kind of go, well, if you've got something inside the violin, like smuggling drugs or something. And of course the answer was, well, no, obviously not, just x-ray it and you can see that there's nothing inside there. Some West Indian players had a slightly different experience recently. They were, well, there are similarities. They were travelling through the US on the, transferring through the US on the way between two games. And the customs officials, obviously being American, unused perhaps to cricket bats, looked very suspiciously upon these objects and wondered what on earth they could be there for, and decided that, of course, they were definitely there to be smuggling drugs. And so Lendl Simmons, the West Indian batsman of some repute, his bat ended up having a few it was drilled into in various places, essentially, so that the customs officials could decide whether there were drugs hidden within it. The startling things are, well, severalfold, one of which is just that they couldn't have just used an x-ray, second of which is that they decided to just wreck a really good cricket bat, third of which is I'm not sure how actually just drilling a few times into a bat would decide that there was or wasn't drugs inside it. And it was just a slightly sad tale of the fact that, you know, everyone comes under suspicion nowadays, and even a decent bit of willow isn't safe from the joys of international travel.
It's also probably a good reminder to us of how far cricket still has to travel in the US as a sport. There's been a huge amount of coverage recently on the BBC about how Americans have apparently really embraced football since the World Cup. But this incident might be a clue that cricket still has a long way to go there. From the archives, and this episode, Toby, who grew up in a village in Norfolk that only discovered electricity shortly after his birth, is going to give us the history of an iconic cricketing video game.
Thank you, Andy. Yes, I do have a confession, which is that although as a child I was totally cricket mad, and, you know, whenever at night after my parents had turned my light out, I stood on my bed and scored test centuries with air shots, and I had a radio in my pocket with TMS on it all the time, I have never in my life played a cricket computer game. Actually, that's not entirely true. I once played one for about 5 minutes, and I rapidly got bored when I realised that the selectors didn't have the same opinion of Rob Key's abilities that I did. And so actually, computer video games are things that have just passed me by throughout my entire life. And so for this from the archives, I thought I'd look into one of the more famous ones. So essentially, video games have been around since the 1950s, and of course the earlier ones were pretty primitive. Basically, in the early days, you could only have so many variables available in the interaction between the gamer and the device. So you had games like Tennis for Two, which is basically you just kind of moved a racket up, down, left, right, and blocked a ball back across the net. And
well,
this is exactly
why, like Pong, isn't it? Which is sort of the eternal classic. And I know people who learn computer programming.
And Tetris is the same.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I know people who learn computer programming now. Apparently, one of the first things they're asked to do is learn to program Pong. It seems like an early skill.
Right,
you're
okay,
quite right. It's literally just, it is literally just simplified tennis. It's a ball going back and forth between two moving blocks.
And that's exactly, that kind of limitation is exactly why a cricket video game didn't emerge for quite a long time. Because actually, in order for cricket to be interesting, you have to have a lot more variance in there. If it's just a bat going left, right, up, down to block a ball, you might as well be playing Pong or something else. Mm. And actually, you need to be able to control how the ball's bowled, who it's bowled by, what kind of bowler it's bowled by, the timing and the placement of the shot, the field, the placement of the fielders, you know, all of that kind of thing. But eventually, of course, technology did catch up with cricket. It's not usually thought of that way around, but technology did catch up with cricket. And one of the first major cricket computer games was Graham Gooch's Test Cricket, released in 1985. I mean, those were the days when Graham Gooch was kind of the forerunner of technology in the world. Graham Gooch and his moustache. So this game had two modes. You could either basically be a manager or a player. So there was an arcade mode in which you selected your players and then you controlled the batsman. So you played the shots, you decided where to stand in the crease, you decided where to hit the ball. Then there was something else called simulation mode, where you were just the manager. You selected your players and you sat back and watched as the computer played them off against one another. And Graham Gooch's Test Cricket was actually made by the same company that made the cricket game, which is the one that was sort of definitely present through all the years that we were growing up, which was, of course, Brian Lara Cricket. So the way that Brian Lara Cricket developed is quite interesting, because in 1994, Graham Gooch was coming towards the end of his career. He wasn't the player that he once was. And the game basically twigged the fact that, as well as the kind of technological advances within the video game itself, as important as anything was the name that was on the cover. And, of course, the new darling of the all-conquering West Indian side, Brian Lara, was the perfect person to be this.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because the contrast between Gooch and Lara is huge. You had Gooch, who was a very sort of dour figure, Lara, who was all flair. I guess the other thing that's slightly genius about it is that if you chose an Englishman, if you chose an Australian, you perhaps end up alienating certain people. You know, the rivalry is that strong between the countries. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even if you choose an Indian. The lovely thing, I guess, about choosing a West Indian is that they've always been a lot of people's B team, isn't it? They've always been the team people's sort of have sympathy for. So choosing someone like Lara is something that actually fans of almost all nations could relate to.
And actually, you have to kind of commend the person who, in 1994, picked Brian Lara as the kind of main name for the game. Because at that stage, yes, he was a very promising batsman. He'd broken a few records, but it was very early on in his career. And you fast forward to seven editions of the game later, as there are now, and Brian Lara is a massive household name, just as Brian Lara Cricket is a massive household name. And the person who actually sat there and took the gamble on Brian Lara being the one who wasn't just a flash in the pan but would carry the game through is really important. But the other thing is, exactly as you say, this thing about national loyalty, something I hadn't realised at all, although, as I say, I realise very few things about cricket computer games or computer games generally, is that actually Brian Lara Cricket, the exact same game, is sold in Australia under the name of Ricky Ponting Cricket and in India under the name of Yuvraj Singh Cricket, which actually says something really interesting about the game, because essentially what they're tapping into is exactly the kind of thing I was doing when I was standing on my bed playing Airshots, which is wanting to be involved in my heroes playing the game and everything like that. So actually the way that these things are marketed is a really, really significant part, I think, of the success of the game. Lara retired in 2007, of course, and so obviously the game's developers needed to move with the times. The next manifestation of the game was branded with the Ashes 2009, and then the next one, which was actually apparently the least successful, was called International Cricket 2010. And you can kind of imagine why International Cricket 2010 is less successful than, you know, Brian Lara, the hero that everyone knows and can envisage and can impersonate.
Yeah, I think I'd sort of like to be again on this idea too about sort of technology having to catch up with cricket as well. I think it's fascinating an idea, because actually I, to my shame, had a more misspent youth and spent a lot more time playing various video games. And what's interesting is that football video games in particular were almost sort of compulsory purchases for football fans, because there was something about football that was actually quite easy to reduce to a video game. It's quite easy to make it arcadey. And it is almost a testament to cricket how hard it is to reduce to a game. And I remember playing the Brian Lara game and finding it frustrating. You made the point about how the technology did get better, so things like the graphics were quite extraordinary. The commentary was hilariously bad. You would have these sort of phrases that would recur again and again and again, apropos of very little going on the pitch. But it is almost a testament to the game how hard it is to catch up, actually.
So for my homework for the next episode, I'm actually going to go away and find a copy of this and play it, and then I'll be able to come back and report back from that perspective.
Well, I actually think what we should do, I've heard extraordinary reports about this new game, this Don Bradman cricket, and I think what we should do, Toby, is both take a week's holiday and just spend a week playing that in anticipation for the next podcast, do a review of it.
Agreed. The review. In this episode, we've been reading Bookie, Gambler, Fixer, Spy, A Journey to the Heart of Cricket's Underworld by Ed Hawkins. Now, Ed Hawkins is an investigative journalist. He's also something of an expert on betting. He's a key tipster, as much as anything, through his Twitter account. And for 12 years, he wrote for the Racing Post. And essentially, this book, as the title suggests, is an investigation into the murky world of spot fixing and corrupt gambling within cricket, mostly based in India. Now, the one question that I got when I got to the end of this book was, should this make me change my opinion of cricket games that I watch as a casual spectator? What was your thought on that?
So one of the games he investigates early on is the England-Sri Lanka test match at Cardiff, where Sri Lanka collapsed astonishingly on the final day of what was a rain-affected match that looked to be drifting to a draw, and England claimed an improbable innings victory. And I remember that game so well. I remember it being such a compelling session. I remember how England just seemingly created this out of nothing. And Hawkins' explanation and the evidence he brought is very convincing to suggest that it was fixed. And I was reading it and I didn't feel cheated. I think that's the phrase a lot of fans use when in relation to match fixing. They're like, oh, it's cheated, it was fraud. I actually felt something, I guess, even worse than that. I felt like something, the game of cricket, which I always think of as kind of this beautiful, wonderful thing, had sort of been sullied. It was worse than, I wasn't really thinking about myself being cheating. I was thinking about this amazing sport that, you know, we're all so proud of, I guess, and so invested in, just being sullied. And I guess I felt sad rather than cheated.
Now, one of the things I really got out of this book is realizing how much ignorance there is around gambling and fixing and bookmakers within cricket, and certainly a lot of ignorance that I shared in. And one of the really interesting parts of the book is this thing about the difference between corrupt players and corrupt bookmakers and actually fixing a game on the one hand, and then on the other hand, on the benefit of just information and bookmakers having information and manipulating odds off the back of that. And actually, he spends a while, there's a chapter towards the end of the book when he essentially throughout the book met a couple of bookmakers in India, and he sort of, you know, makes friends with them, and he goes and he follows them in their day-to-day activities, and it's a whole world that you just don't know about. And part of the joy of this book is discovering that world. But there's a chapter towards the end where he's with a bookmaker and he's with the England team in, I think, Mumbai, is it?
Yes,
in their hotel. And what becomes apparent there is that how easy it is for cricketers to become implicated in this simply by giving information. So things like who's going to bat first, the state of the pitch, who's going to play, can then be used by bookmakers to manipulate odds and create enormous amounts of money. And actually, for me, that was one of the revelations of the book, these distinctions and these subtleties within bookmaking that otherwise we just don't really realise. We just write everything off as a whole kind of mass of corruption.
I mean, he makes the point about information being given rather brilliantly through a casual conversation he has with Ian Bell in the swimming pool at this Mumbai hotel. And he gets some key information, namely the big thing that Bell himself won't be playing in the ODI later that day. And he shows that actually Bell isn't being malicious, Bell's being friendly. You know, he's having a chat with Hawkins, he's a journalist, he knows. And Hawkins, to be very clear, doesn't do this to try to make Bell look bad. He just makes it to show how a conversation between friends can then be misinterpreted as more. I think your point about showing the detail, we all misunderstood how Indian bookmakers worked after the Pakistan spot-fixing scandal because the British media did a terrible job explaining it. I mean, I remember having these discussions with fellow cricket fans. Isn't it ridiculous that in India you're allowed to bet on, you know, which bowler no ball will be bowled? Will the captain turn up wearing sun cream? And I was quoting these, and we all thought this was true because a lot of the papers were running it. And Hawkins rubbishes this and shows that actually this idea that these multi-million dollar markets on absurd non-events, that these just don't exist, and I think he does a very good job on that.
The other thing that is, I think, is revelatory is the description of the way that the bookmaking and betting ring practically works in India. And there's this amazing system whereby you basically get there are a number of different systems that run alongside one another. One of them involves someone with a suitcase, and inside the suitcase is basically rigged up with about 30 mobile phones, and when he sort of talks at the same time, those phone off to 30 different people who all have the same setup, and they all phone off to 30 different people. And suddenly the way that these bookmakers are able to spread information over the entirety of India in no time at all is brilliant. And the other thing that's quite interesting is that, going back to this thing about information being really key, is that they employ someone to go to the ground and sit there on a mobile phone commentating on the game, because actually that then gives them a 6-second advantage over the Sky commentary as it's being broadcast on air, and allows them to then manipulate odds ahead of everyone else who's able to read about it on Cricket Info or watch it on Sky can get the information. So actually the kind of webs that are created by these systems are absolutely fascinating, I thought.
No, I agree with you. It's sort of, in a way, it's quite amateurish. You've got these guys at the ground on mobile phones, but in another way it's so ingenious, that the setup that they've got. One thing that I didn't understand before reading the book was the fact that you've got two very clear different parties involved in this, which is the bookmakers themselves, who obviously have an interest to fix, to get information in order to set their odds in a way beneficial to them. But you've also got these syndicates of bettors as well, of punters, who obviously want to fix, to try and, you know, find something out which will allow them to make money. And I don't think that was something I'd clearly understood, that you've actually got these two very different groups, the bettors and the bookmakers, all trying to get involved, all trying to sort of fix. I would say one of the images that I was left very, very strongly with was Hawkins goes with one of these surprisingly friendly Indian bookmakers to an India game. And Hawkins asks the bookmaker, how can you watch this? How can you enjoy this when your day-to-day job is, you know, corrupting this game?
And
this bookmaker is very blasé. He says, no, I'm not working. Today I'm an Indian fan. And it's extraordinary that he can switch it on and off, that he can turn up one day as a honest fan looking to enjoy a good game, and one day as the person who's undermining that. And finally, to the debate. And this episode, we are asking whether English cricket ultimately benefits from having the Lions team. And this topic came from a discussion I heard on TMS earlier in the week between Alison Mitchell and Geoffrey Boycott. And Boycott was very strongly making the point that in his day, I mean, with Geoffrey, it inevitably is about what it was in his day. And he was saying they didn't have a Lions equivalent. And he felt that, in particular, this was weakening the county game, pulling players out of big games from his own perspective. In Yorkshire, he was saying, well, look, Yorkshire keep losing our big players to this. And Alison Mitchell made the point, but look, it's about getting players to know each other. It's about getting them into the England setup. It's about getting England coaches to be able to see these players close up.
I suppose, you know, it is a kind of swings and roundabouts thing, in the sense that playing on the county circuit, you get a huge deal of variety in your game. You're playing week in, week out against a large range of players, but there are certainly things which are distinctive to the international game, such as going on tour, for instance, also being thrust together with players who you haven't necessarily played with for a long time, and just having to adapt to that. And then suddenly, you know, in general, although it's a bit of a generalization, but in general, county teams are pretty stable, whereas there can be quite a lot of chopping and changing with national teams, and actually, therefore, there must be some attributes to playing to your country that you don't get from playing for your county.
I think it's actually, you've echoed one of the points that Alison Mitchell actually made, this idea that isn't it scary coming into a dressing room when you don't know anyone? And isn't it good to prepare for that? And Jeff Boycott kind of shook it off and said, well, you know, of course, that's just the game. And I guess you could argue it both ways, because maybe it is just the job of England's senior players to just make new players feel welcome, you know, and maybe you don't need an intermediary step. I guess a lot of the question comes down to, do you get a better experience as a young player playing a Lions game than you do playing a county game? You know, I'd like to think actually that a top division county game is probably of a higher standard than a Lions versus New Zealand A game. You know, it's difficult to say, but I'm not necessarily convinced that you're being exposed to a higher standard of cricket by playing at that.
Certainly there is this kind of assumption that if someone is to... if someone has been playing for the full England team and has fallen out of form or fallen out of favour or whatever reason, they often sort of go back down to the Lions, as it were, to spend a bit of time there, get their game back before then going back into the full England setup. And I wonder whether part of that kind of progression is, in a sense, because the England management wants to be able to keep an eye on them, in the sense that they can't keep an eye on players in the county game. And by keep an eye on, I mean just be able to monitor and see how their game's progressing, what their weaknesses are and what their strengths are, and when they are back in form and things like that. So maybe that's kind of part of the benefit of it, is that once these players are within the England setup, within the international setup, and increasingly we do see a bit of a gulf between the counties and the international players, as much as anything, because international players play so much international cricket, they basically never do play county cricket.
I agree with you that I think it's become a real trend to get players like Bapara, James Taylor, Stephen Finn into the Lions, players who've actually had a bit of an international career already. And I personally don't really understand that. I don't see, you're not learning anything new about those players. They're players that you've seen quite a lot of. I wonder if increasing the Lions isn't just being used as a way of signalling long-term intent. You're saying, oh, we want you in our camp. I thought it was very interesting. I play cricket with a very rabid Middlesex fan who's been telling me for a while that Ravi Patel, a young Middlesex spinner, is the future of English cricket. And I saw he was picked for the Lions. And I felt like that was an interesting way of the England selectors. They're saying, okay, you're not quite ready for, obviously, inclusion in the full team, but this is just our way of saying, oh, we notice you. You know, we're taking it seriously. There is a big problem, though, in terms of undermining the county championship. And this is where I think I have a lot of sympathy for the boycott position. You know, if I'm Yorkshire and I want to win the county championship, I can accept that, you know, Gary Balance has gone and played for England. You know, can I accept that Johnny Bairstow's gone and been picked for the Lions? Is that reasonable to take him to go off and play? Why shouldn't he be, you know, fighting in the championship for me and for Yorkshire?
I suppose as much as anything, there needs to be a kind of a mindful balance of how much the Lions, because there is a sense in which the Lions is a development squad, and therefore it would be inappropriate for players to be playing constantly for them and never for their county. So I suppose as much as anything, it's just a balance between time spent with your county and time spent with the Lions. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the 60th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. It's become a bit of a custom that at the end of every episode we apologise for how long it's been since the previous episode. I find myself having to do that again, and once again I'll say that we have the best intentions not to leave it so long next time.